everyone, this is Matt. Welcome to another episode of Takeout with Ashley Coff RD and Rowan O'Brien, discussing better nutrition simplified in the new food economy. Who's up for a food awakening? Right, today we have Congressman Tim Ryan on the show. Tim is a relentless advocate for working families in Ohio's 13th district. He was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2002 and was sworn in on January 2003. Successfully re-elected six times, he is now serving in his seventh term. Congress Ryan currently serves as a member of the powerful House Appropriations Committee, which controls the expenditure of money by the federal government. Ryan is also a member of the House Budget Committee, which has oversight over the federal budget process. Ryan serves as co-chairman of the Congressional Manufacturing Caucus and remains a leader in the fight to strengthen America's manufacturing base and reform U.S. trade policies. I had the pleasure of hearing Tim speak at Wisdom 2.0 in San Francisco earlier this year. And he's just a wealth of knowledge and a great speaker. And you're going to love this podcast. I'm really looking forward to it. Right, like I've been doing the last two or three weeks, I've been reading our iTunes reviews. Thank you for sending them in. I'm loving it. Today I'm going to read one, Practical Tips for Better Health. Ashley and Robin have so much knowledge to share. Their simple, down-to-earth approach to food and nutrition, combined experience working with clients and informed perspectives on food policies, trends, fads, and popular misconceptions in the food space make this amazing resource for better health. This podcast is one of my go-to resources for staying informed so I can make good choices. Well, thanks for that. Loving this review. Keep them coming in and I will read yours out. Even if there's something in it that you want us to improve, please send them in. Right, let's get over to this podcast today. Like I said, it's going to be a cracker. Right, over to you, ladies.
Ashley and I are absolutely thrilled to have our friend Congressman Tim Ryan on today. He is the congressman out of Ohio that I had the opportunity to do a presentation with last summer in Cleveland, and he is just such a force for good. He's a dad of three, football player, so he comes at this whole system analysis with this kind of team background. And as he and I were presenting together in Ohio last year, you know, we both kind of were coming at it from this Team USA. Like, what are we going to do here if these kids are so sick? And whether we're talking about obesity or diabetes or asthma or allergies or the fact that 7 out of 10 young people can't serve in the military, like, that's our team. And we can't put them on the field like that. And so Congressman Ryan, as a dad of three, he sees it firsthand. His wife is a school teacher. She sees it firsthand. And he really has been an incredible voice for this movement of, you know, better food, better nutrition, a mindfulness to bringing that inside DEC. So huge thank you for your work, not only on the policy front, but particularly on this.
You got it. It's great to be with you. I'm just really excited about everything that's happening in the world. I feel like we're building a critical mass here of people who are super excited about, you know, making some big changes in ways that are going to be transformational. You know, I just feel like the food issue and the mindfulness issue are so fundamental that they can help transform and help kind of change the whole trajectory of the country. And so it's exciting to meet great people like you, you know, from different backgrounds and different parts of the country and kind of join together. And this network's emerging, and it's really, really exciting.
Yeah, so I kind of want to dial people back a little bit who may not be familiar with your background. And, you know, I know that when you spoke about your grandmother's cooking, this Italian cooking, the fact you played football. I mean, you're so all-American, and I think that that's really, really important. And I see it, you know, having come out of Texas where it's like, you know, people think maybe the foodie people are kind of on the coast. You know, it's either a California thing or a New York City thing. But really what we're seeing is that it's a patriotic thing. And, you know, I would love if you could share with our listeners a little bit of, you know, what brought you from that football playing guy to where you are now.
Well, it's, you know, it's just in where I am now, like most people, you know, it's just an extension of where I was. And the kind of growing up with Italian grandparents and, you know, just outside of Youngstown, Ohio, and then being an athlete and all of that, I think, you know, the athletic piece really defined me. I mean, the food piece was something I just grew up with and just kind of really had an appreciation for, you know, fresh food from the garden. You know, we'd always be able to tell what the meals were going to be by what my grandparents were picking out of the garden. You know, if they've got the peppers, it was going to be probably chicken and peppers, homemade, you know, just fresh stuff, and the tomatoes for the sauce, or even just the tomatoes, just to eat tomatoes, slicing them up with a little olive oil on them. And so I always had a real appreciation for the home cooking. And remember my grandmother getting really mad when we would ever order a pizza out, you know, because she would get really excited and said, you should have called me and I'd come down and I could have made you a homemade pizza, you know. I mean, so that was kind of the experience I grew up with, and that always has stuck with me, to have that appreciation for kind of the homemade food. And the athletic piece, really, I just feel like I was so much defined by athletics and being a quarterback through my high school career, and then a little bit into college before I got hurt, because it was, being a quarterback is very pragmatic. It's very practical, and you have to, it's great training for anything, because you have to have a strategy, and then there are tactics within the strategy, and the strategy is based on what your assets are that you have on the team, but it's also based on what are the assets of the other team, the challenges that you may face. But it's also about how do you get the chemistry to work within the team. And sometimes you don't always have the best players, but the best teams sometimes have the best chemistry. So all of that I took with me, and how all of that is interconnected. And when I got into public life, I think I brought that skill set to say, okay, how is all this interconnected? And so it wasn't long before I started to see, especially once I got on the Appropriations Committee, which is the committee that spends the money from the federal government, once I was in Congress and then moved up, because I really started to see the healthcare issue is not separate from the agricultural and food issues. And neither of those issues were separated from the education aspect of our society. And all of those tied into the long-term budget for the country of, you know, we have these huge deficits and what are we going to do with them? And most of those are driven by healthcare. And so we have a kind of an argument in Washington, not to get too much into this, but the argument is, how can we cut these healthcare programs so that we can balance the budget? And to me, that's, can be very cruel to say to someone you can't have health care when we have you living in a system that is a disease control system that just waits till you get really sick and then we try to take care of you, and that's very expensive, as opposed to teaching, training, and having our system work where everyone has access to the fresh foods that can keep them healthy, as opposed to the highly processed foods they're eating now that's making them sick, that's driving up healthcare costs, that lead to this debate we're having about the long-term budget. So being a quarterback and being in sports, I think, helped me as a problem solver, quite frankly, and I still carry that with me today.
True. In the discipline of a team, I like the comment that you made that sometimes the best teams don't necessarily have the best players, but they have the best chemistry.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we see that in this movement, is that everybody's coming to the table with a bunch of different skills and a bunch of different talents. And when you're leveraging that collectively, that can create extraordinary change, I think, that couldn't have happened individually. Mm-hmm. I like how you hit on how, you know, we live in this system that is, it's about disease control. It's really not about healthcare, because if you really step back, true healthcare begins with our food. And I know that you've written a book about that. You know, we've had different journalists on. We had a Wall Street Journal guy on, and he was saying nutrition is a fundamental cornerstone of all developmental progress. And so somewhere along the way, we lost sight of that. And that needs to be an investment in all programs. You know, good nutrition is a sound investment in education. Good nutrition is a sound investment in our military. Good nutrition is a sound investment in innovation and entrepreneurship. And somewhere along the way, we lost sight of that. And you are this voice inside of DC who is really advocating for that. And are you confronting, like, how is that being received, and how has it been as you try to build that team?
Well, DC and Congress and the Senate, they in a lot of ways are very reflective of the country, you know, and their approach, demeanor, knowledge, information, way of living in the world. Especially in the House of Representatives, which is very close to their constituents, so very much reflect their constituents. And so I think the issue of food is starting to percolate up, but I don't think the legislative branch has really connected the dots to the long-term costs, as I was talking about earlier, and what we need to do within the context of the food system, the crops that we subsidize with taxpayer money to keep them artificially cheap so that the fast food that you buy is artificially cheap. You know, you go to McDonald's and it's five for five, right? Five hamburgers for $5. And it's like, well, it's not really $5. It's, you know, the corn that's going into the meat, the cattle is all highly subsidized by the taxpayer. So it doesn't accurately reflect, you know, the real cost of the cattle. And the bun, for example, is, you know, highly subsidized. The crops that go into the bun are highly subsidized. The ketchup is highly subsidized. You know, all of these things are very highly subsidized from their original crops. And so it should be much more expensive. But trying to connect that dot with the long-term healthcare costs of someone who eats that fast food or eats highly processed food or doesn't eat homemade meals or home-cooked meals at all throughout the course of their life, or they eat Fritos, or like a lot of the kids in the school, you know, they'll have a chocolate milk and a Rice Krispie bar for breakfast, which is, you know, 50 or 60 grams of sugar, and then expected to learn. Like you said, it's fundamental to education. But to tie that to educational attainment and long-term costs in our healthcare programs has been tough because a lot of people eat that kind of food. And so it's very personal to say, you know, and I'm not a prude either. I mean, we eat ice cream, you know, my family, we sit down and that's one of the things we enjoy, and we're not perfect. We're, you know, 70-80% good, but I'm not here to be a prude. I'm just saying that this is an issue we all need to address. And so it's been hard, quite frankly. But what's been exciting, and what I think can be even more exciting and really add to it, is, like you said, this emerging coalition that's happening, these celebrity chefs that are not just about getting on TV and being famous and cooking food and getting people in their restaurants, but the Tom Colecchios of the world and others who are even just famous in their own cities that are working on school lunches and working on healthy food options and working on supporting farmers markets. And, you know, all of these things start to help. So while it's not where I'd like it to be today, and there are some solid voices in Congress, I like what I see emerging in the way people are talking about really having access to this fresh fruit and vegetable and lean meats and those kind of things is a real right in America.
You know, Tim, I'm struck by something. It's Ashley. First of all, I love what you're saying. And by the way, perfect should never be an aspiration. There is no such thing as perfect nutrition. So we want to be clear on that part. But we had a physician on the other day who I think the way she phrased this I thought was so excellent. And she said, health is a resource. It's not a goal. And as such, you know, health enables us, as a resource, it enables us to do what we want to do. And one of the things that I'm struck with in particular being in D.C., also, you know, being from Ohio and now being in D.C., and, you know, I have several of your colleagues as clients, as patients of mine, you know, on the individual level, when we eat better, we perform better. And we have people in our lives, you know, whether it's our kids or our parents or our friends, and we see what better nutrition does for them or what lack of better nutrition is preventing them from getting, you know, the challenges. And so one of the things that I struggle with is, you know, again, thinking about my patients who are like you, you know, sitting there voting, and when they vote for a policy that is against nutrition as a resource or enabling health as a resource, but yet I know that they're personally working on their nutrition, or, you know, I was over on the Hill and went into the cafeteria. You guys have done, like, great improvements in a couple of areas in the cafeteria, and there were other things that I was seeing that I was like, I can't believe that this is what's being offered for people, you know, here to eat. So I guess what I'm struck with is, you know, how is that dichotomy, like, it's hard to feel that we people are voting or in their work lives behaving differently than what they're trying to accomplish in their personal lives. And I guess I'm trying to understand that part a little bit better, if you can help.
I don't know if I can help. It's a really kind of the the main question of how do you connect the personal to the public or the personal to the collective, which is always kind of a tough thing to do. But when you're talking about performance, and I'm going to take a swing at this anyway, when you're talking about performance, part of that, if we want to allow people to reach their full potential, starts with a healthy diet. And so I try to tie that into people being more creative, working and functioning at a higher level, improves their performance, so that they can be a better entrepreneur or a better worker or a better business person or a better teacher, whatever. That really, as a country, we only have 313 million people. And we are competing with, the globe, 1.3 or 4 billion people in China, 1.3 or 4 billion people in India, the European Union, on and on and on and on. So because we have such a small number of people, we have to have everybody on the field playing for us, like we were talking about in Cleveland, Team USA. I mean, we need you on the field playing for us, and we need you playing at a high level. So for us to try to do that, we obviously we have our individual approaches, and everybody has different ways of getting themselves to be functioning at a higher level with food and other habits that they can develop. But our job really is to create systems that people can thrive in. And those systems are never perfect, and they're always changing. But right now we're stuck. We're in a system where we really need people to be functioning at a high level, because you're not just going to work in a steel mill. We need you to be creative, dynamic, figuring out renewable energy or figuring out new ways to manufacture or to communicate or to teach in schools or healthcare and all of these things. So we need to create a system that allows people to thrive in ways that they never have before. And to me, that's why it's so important to get to the collective action, because we need, you can't fix the farm subsidy system unless you are, able to have legislation that puts resources to specialty crops and fresh fruits and vegetables and produce, as opposed to these large industrial-sized farm companies and crops that make their way into highly processed food. So the idea is, how do we transfer from the personal to the collective, in the sense that we have to change the system so that everyone can thrive within that system, or at least a higher percentage of people can thrive within that system. Yes, I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's what I was thinking about when you said that.
No, and I think you're absolutely right. And I want to give you an opportunity, because not only am I from Ohio, but I have also, through, with Dr. Hyman and some of the others, had some connections with Cleveland Clinic. And I'd love to give you an opportunity, because there are some game-changing programs and things that are happening in Ohio that I think really are creating the change that we need to see. And so I'd love to hear, just a couple of them that come to mind, because there are so many. But brag on Ohio for a minute, other than the Cavs, which we can always brag about.
Well, I think there are some cool things going on. I can share with you a little bit. One of the school districts, and this kind of ties everything together, not just the food piece, but one of the schools in my district, about 5 years ago, I was able to get a little bit of money for them to do a social and emotional learning program in the school. And so this really focuses on cultivating emotional intelligence and social intelligence, and how directly connected that is to behavior, obviously, but also academic performance. And this school is doing phenomenal things. So that school is great, Warren City Schools. What we added on to that most recently, and this really hasn't been announced yet, but what the hell, let's do it right now. Whole Foods selected Warren City Schools for a grant to help them redo their food system and be able to provide technical support to help them access better, healthier foods. So, breakfast, lunch and potentially after school, which is really cool. Because if you're doing kind of the mindfulness, social and emotional learning piece, which we're doing now, and you add the food piece, now you're starting to like really connect what is going to help these kids be able to thrive. And then we have another component coming in with art and music and tying the music programs and the art programs to the community art programs. So to me, this is like the Tim Ryan dream school of the 21st century. It's like if we don't have these couple, two, three pieces in place, really foundational, what I'm calling the real common core is awareness practices, attention practices to help you focus and have the mental discipline that you need to be able to really thrive and be resilient, get knocked down, but get back up. We got to teach those skills, and we should be teaching those skills. Those are the same skills that are really underneath, more fundamental than we have these bullying classes and we have sex ed classes and we have, you know, drug and alcohol prevention and all of this stuff, the teen pregnancy stuff. Really, all of those are just symptoms of a broader problem, a deeper problem that the social and emotional learning and the techniques you learn to self-regulate and be connected and all of those actually solve all of those problems, or at least address all of those problems. And then you have the food piece, so you're functioning at a high level, your body can come back into balance, so it heals itself, so you're not sick as much, and you're able to think and concentrate. We're not, you know, gumming the works up with a bunch of sugar. So then you're functioning, and you also have your creativity piece on the art and music, and given other avenues for kids to be able to latch on to something. You know, I had sports, but somebody else may have speech and debate. Somebody else may have a musical instrument. Somebody else may be a singer. Someone else may be a dancer. All of those opportunities need to be available for some kid to latch onto. You know, we can't just say, okay, STEM. I'm a big STEM proponent, but it can't just be STEM, because what if you're not in the STEM? Then what are you, left of the curb and you have no pathway? Because from music, you can go into math, and then that can help you develop, because music really is math. So we've got to provide all these opportunities. So the thing I'm most proud of in Ohio is what's happening in the school, in Warren City Schools, because it's not just one of those elements. It's all of the elements. And clearly we could get into the Cleveland Clinic, what Mark Hyman's doing with functional medicine in Cleveland, really flipping the whole healthcare system on its head with saying, how do we make your body healthy so that it will heal itself? We're not going to heal you. Your body's going to heal itself, but we need to create the conditions in your body for balance and optimal health, and the body will heal itself for the most part. So those are two things that I'm really psyched about, as you could probably tell.
You know, just listening to you talk, especially this Whole Foods partnership with the Warren City Schools, that public-private partnership, I think that is 21st century thinking. I think it's, we're not going to wait for policy to move. We're not going to wait for the corporations to fix this. This is a marriage of both. This is all hands on deck now. And I think to move it from the personal to the collective, that's starting to happen. And the place that we're seeing that happen first is the school, because this generation of kids has earned that title of Generation RX because of the rates of obesity and ADHD and autism and allergies and diabetes and all these things. So All of a sudden, where we maybe could keep it to ourselves, you know, tucked into a closet at home, you know, when you go into those schools every day, especially with the younger children, you go into those schools every single day and you see what those nurses are dealing with, you can't ignore it anymore. You can't not see it. And I think that's where we're going to start to see this change happen first. I really hope that this whole process will be documented almost like a case study in order to be able to really follow these kids through and show and demonstrate, you know, numerically with the data exactly how this is going to impact, because it's extraordinary. I wish that every public school system around the country had access to something like this.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, you may find interesting, one of the things we're trying to do, and I just talked to my team about this, and because I went on Tuesday, I was in New York and I was coming down to D.C. and I stopped in Philly. They have a great food program in one of the schools there where a foundation, like you said, kind of, you know, NGOs and nonprofits working with the charter school there, hired, you know, a person to do technical support for a school to try to improve the school lunch, and they work with the local chef. He's famous in Philadelphia, kind of a local celebrity chef kind of guy. And I sat there and I ate lunch, and it was so cool. They had round tables, so it wasn't kind of the square tables. Eight kids sat at a round table, so they had to talk to each other. One kid was a was called the table captain, and he would wear, or she would wear, a chef's jacket, you know, a white jacket. And they were in charge of going to get the food, and the food was all served family style. So they went, they got the food, they brought it back. This person was in charge. They had to make sure that everybody took at least one scoop of the, got a piece of chicken, and the food was unbelievable. I will tell you, it was like I was at a restaurant. It was like lemon pepper chicken, a little bit of like a small wheat pasta with, you know, vegetables in it, cauliflower that was unbelievable. The kids were getting like second helpings of the cauliflower. I mean, incredible. And in a really, really tough neighborhood in Philly, this was all happening. And these kids weren't just learning about food, but they were also learning how to talk, how to set the table. I mean, all of these things were coming together. It was just so amazing. Like I said, and the food was great. And so that was like a really great experience. So I was just thinking, and I think why you guys will like this is because all of those kids, and I asked the principal, almost all of those kids in that school were on the Medicaid program, which is health care for our poorest citizens, okay? Almost the entire school. They were 100% free and reduced lunch. He didn't know the Medicaid numbers, but he said it's got to be close to 100%. So here we are as a society today. We will cover every one of these kids in the Medicaid program, as we should, but now they got very high rates of diabetes, they have terrible diets, and they're going to come into the Medicaid program. We won't help them on the front end at all with food, diet, nutrition, but boy, once you get diabetes, come on in, we'll take care of you at a very, very high cost. So I was just talking about to my staff, how do we create a waiver or an ability for a local school who has over 80% of their kids are on the Medicaid program to throw that school $50,000 or a school district $100,000, whatever the number would be, to be able to hire that one person to do the technical support, because they were doing this all on the current budget for that they get for the school lunch program. It was $1.20 or $1.30 a kid, you know, per meal, which isn't a whole lot. But they were able to do all of this with that money, but they needed the person in the school to be able to coordinate it and find out where the local produce was coming from and find out what the best deal was on the arugula or the kale. They were saying they had these kids going back to get kale seconds of kale salad. I mean, it's like, awesome. You couldn't draw it up. But here we are in the old Medicaid system where we're going to wait, and what we're saying is, what's America 2.0 look like, or America 3.0, or a new version of America? That is the public-private partnerships using Medicaid for real prevention, and now we know that real prevention isn't just screenings. That's still a little bit upstream. We need to go further downstream and say, let's start in our schools that have high concentrations of poverty, many of the kids on Medicaid that we know we're going to be seeing. Let's try to give them a little bit of money to play offense instead of waiting for these costs to skyrocket. And if you do that collectively, systematically, you're going to save billions of dollars in the Medicaid program. Now you can put some of that money to balance the budget, but then you can also maybe spend some of that money on making sure that these schools have art and music programs. They have after school programs and summer school programs, because food isn't the only issue. You got to keep these kids busy. You got to give them avenues. But if we get smart, you know, we can talk about doing this, and you're certainly not going to go to the taxpayer right now and say, hey, we need more money and we need to throw it into a system that's broken. I really believe that if you get these systems working, people would want to help. They would say, yeah, this is really moving in the right direction. I like what they're doing, and this is something I'm willing to support. And so, you know, we've got to come up with ways of doing that. And this gets back to the whole quarterback thing, right? I'm looking at this whole situation. How do you fix it? What's going on here? Then, you know, going out and about and learning about new places and then figuring out, okay, how do you maneuver that within the legislative process? And get average people saying, yeah, that's exactly what I want someone to do with my money that I'm sending, my hard-earned money that I send into the federal government. That sounds like something I can support.
I know. I think about, you know, I often will say when I give these talks, if people knew that 1% of the subsidies are going towards fruits and vegetables, only 1%, and everything else is going into this like monoculture of corn and soy. Mm-hmm. You know, if we got to check a box when we were mailing in our taxes, you know, would we check the box that says, yes, I do want my taxes supporting this chemically intensive operating system that has become industrial ag, or yes, I want my taxes supporting local organic agriculture and, you know, access to clean and healthy foods for kids. And, you know, right now, that imbalance at the federal level with the federal budget is so massive. It just, yeah. It's so stacked against the farmers who are trying to do the right thing. And, you know, not to knock on the farmers because, you know, they've got to feed their families too. So they're going to move to the more financially lucrative option. And if we can level that playing field, if we can bring a parity at the playing field, you know, then it allows the farmers to truly choose the system that their values are aligned with too. And it creates, you know, as you're saying, I mean, it has a ripple effect across the entire economic system. And, you know, it is. I mean, I think what we're doing is we're waking up to this realization again that this 20th century system that we've inherited does not work for 21st century families. And so it is up to us to build that team and build that better food system. And so we still are, you know, in the early innings of that game.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. And it's all about changing the system. And, you know, I think it's exciting. I mean, this is like an exciting time to be engaged in this kind of work because the changes can be so significant and so transformative. And part of what we need to do is get these young millennials excited about it too. You know, whether you're talking about going into farming, because the majority of our farmers are really aging out. I think the average age is 55 or 60 years old for the average farmer. So we're going to need more farmers and finding ways to get returning veterans into farming or these young millennials into farming, I think is a great opportunity and help and facilitate that process. But like you said, the part of the farm bill, which is the budget we do every 5 years and the money we send every 5 years to our farmers, that's a very, very small piece of the grand package, which is mostly based on subsidies, money that goes to farmers for these specialty crops. And you can't blame the farmers either. I mean, they have kids in school and mortgages and capital investments that they've made because that was the system. And so, but I think it's almost even worth paying the farmers more of a subsidy than they're getting now to do the kind of the big row crop and the with the industrial farming, because of having the market in a surplus of fresh fruits and vegetables going into food deserts and being accessible in schools and all the rest, it'd almost be worth it to, because you're going to save on the healthcare costs. So you provide a little more incentive for them to do the produce, the fresh fruits and vegetables, than you are for the row crop. You'll see that market move. And then you can also create markets for them to sell the product to. So we have tons of money that we spend, public money that we spend on schools, prisons, universities, and other public entities in which we buy a ton of food. But we're buying the highly processed food, military bases, I mean, on and on and on, government buildings at all levels. So if we help the farmer move in that direction, and then in our public spending, we start carving out how more and more of that should be spent on fresh fruits and vegetables, you help the farmer transition, and then you also create a market for them. That's how you begin to tie the whole system together, and that's how you get really, you're really able to ramp up the kind of change that you want.
You know, I know Ashley's going to jump into questions, but I've, you know, as you know, I do a lot of advisory work for the food industry, and some pretty massive food companies, you know, in the last several months have approached me on how to help that transition. And again, I think it gets back to this concept of public-private partnership. How do you create a market for the transition products that are going to come off those farms as they transition from this chemically intensive, genetically engineered operating system to something that has less toxic inputs? And, you know, I know that any time that I speak with one of these companies, you know, they're always asking, you know, who are the policymakers inside that understand this and the scope and the scale of this? And it's just, again, it is just so great, Tim, to listen to you because you have such a just incredible understanding of the scale of this thing.
Yeah, and I like completely echo that. And I think the other part is, you know, we need to inspire the younger generation to want to be farmers. And one way to inspire them is to make sure that they're, you know, what you're laying out is also just a great program for being able to say that this has the potential to be a lucrative career for you. And mm-hmm. it should be, you know, the people that are, again, you know, a primary part in our nation's most critical resource. So I think it's incredible. We're going to shift gears for a second. We have this rapid fire. So very quick answers and first ones that come to mind, a series of questions. Really, we want to, you know, this is about you at this point. And we want our audience to get to know you on that part. So I'm going to jump right in. So for you, Tim, the greatest obstacle that you've overcome personally?
I feel really blessed. I feel like I haven't had a whole lot of like huge challenges. And I guess that's a good sign. But I guess growing up, you know, little family problems at home and stuff like that, where, you know, my parents were divorced and that kind of thing, was something that I kind of had to deal with as a young person and overcome and kind of move on. Figure out how to make that whole thing work in my life. So I would say that was probably one of the bigger ones.
In this one, when I'm talking about the movement, we're talking about sort of better food, better health movement. You've spoken a lot about this, but if we had to really hone in on what you see the greatest opportunity you see in this movement.
Well, this sounds kind of crass, but economically, if you have a country full of really healthy people, you are going to have a really robust and very creative economy, and you're going to have people that are really able to reach for the stars because they're going to be functioning at a higher level, and that starts with, you know, the healthy foods and all of that. And so I think the end game, if there ever is an end game, is the reaching of potential that is out there right now that we're not tapping into because people are lethargic and kids are lethargic in school because of what they're putting in their bodies.
If that is crass, please just be crass every day, because that is a so need that message. I mean, it is so crystal clear. We so need that message. So you inspire both of us so tremendously. So we would love to ask you, who inspires you and why?
You know, I get inspired by really big thinkers. So, you know, Lori David, for example, who did the Fed Up, which is her latest documentary, and, you know, Inconvenient Truth. She did that with Al Gore. Really is an inspiration for me. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was my mindfulness teacher, my first mindfulness teacher, who brought secular mindfulness to the United States, really, and started to study it, really saw it as a potential game changer for our healthcare industry. Guys like Pete Carroll, coach of the Seahawks, and Phil Jackson, who are trying to apply a lot of these methods to athletics. I really find that super, super inspiring. And you know, not to be political, but I do find, you know, the Clintons very inspiring. I mean, if you look at what they're pushing, what they get excited about, their policies for a variety of different economic and innovative solutions to our problems. I find that stuff that they're pushing really, really exciting. And, you know, try to find it in a lot of different places, but I find it both, you know, these celebrity chefs and people like you. I mean, you guys inspire me. I was like almost in tears yesterday in the school because I was just so excited that this local chef who I'd never heard of and this local foundation that I never heard of was doing such great work. So it's like the people on the ground too are so inspirational because they're doing it without any, you know, 60 minutes isn't there to cover them. You know, they're just doing it because it's working and they want to change kids' lives. And so I try to find that kind of inspiration everywhere, and it really is everywhere if you're willing to look for it.
I think, you know, there's just so much purpose and there's so much passion in this movement, and that is so contagious. And I think the way you hit on how you can find that in all of these different places, I love that you hit on Pete Carroll. There was a journalist that was doing a book on leadership, and she was interviewing just all of these amazing, recognizable names, and, you know, was going in to interview Pete Carroll of the Seahawks and didn't really know who he was or who the team was. And she said her takeaway through the entire book was that this guy has this really extraordinary way of inspiring people and leading. And I'm married to a Seahawks fan, a guy from Seattle, so I hear a lot about Pete Carroll. And I think that that kind of message, you know, and again, it gets back to this sports metaphor, the fact that we are all on the same team, that in order to have the economic win, we have to play together. So the next question really touches on that. And I know you're given this opportunity a lot. But I think, you know, I would invite you to sort of think forward to, you know, another decade into your career. What one message would you send to Congress?
Step up your game, you know, be a little bit less concerned about your reelection and also be interested in new ideas. I guess, you know, the politics are the politics and everybody's worried about getting reelected. But if I had one thing to say to everyone, I'd say get outside your comfort zone. Read a book about something that may stimulate a new way of thinking. I just think we have so many people here, they're great guys. I mean, they're not bad people, but they just get so caught up in how they know things to be and how they used to be that they're not really willing to go out and look for new solutions to these older problems. And I think that's really the hang up here. You know, and it's part, you know, institutional. I mean, they stopped really for the last few years. Like a lot of the travel that we used to do as members of Congress was pared back. You know, there's no incentive to write books. You know, for example, you can't get an advance on a book if you're a member of Congress, you know, which to me sounds like, okay, we don't want you doing, you know, making money for not writing books. And of course that would be wrong, but don't you want your leaders out thinking, writing, traveling, figuring things out, seeing things? I don't think that the body has really adapted to what we need to learn things again, and that means getting out and about, reading and writing. So I would just say get off your butt and go to a school that's doing a cool little, you know, food program and see if that will connect the dots for you for the bigger picture things about budgets and healthcare and all the rest we talked about.
I love it. I love it. Get out of your comfort zone and that we need new solutions to these old problems. So here's our last question, and it's an easy one. If you were a food, what would you be?
That's a heck of a good question. I don't know. It'd probably be a tomato. I have no idea why. It's probably because I'm Italian.
I was going to say, it's your grandmother, you know?
Yeah.
Keeps coming back.
Ode to Grandma Rizzi there. She'd be proud of that.
Well, Tim, I mean, we are the hugest fans. So
thank
grateful
you.
That you have devoted yourself in the way that you have, with the attitude that you have. And huge congrats on that win for those schools in Ohio. They are so lucky.
Thank you. Well, great to be with you, and thanks for all the work. And let's put something together we could do that would be really cool.
Very cool. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for that. What a great podcast. I keep trying to think to myself, what do I see the world being like in 50 years' time? And I think it's going to be great. I think the moves we're making now are going to create this change, and the world's going to be a better place for it. So let's keep doing it. Right. On to next week, we have Roger Thoreau on the show. He is a senior fellow in global food and agriculture for the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He previously spent 30 years at the Wall Street Journal, 20 of them as a foreign correspondent based in Europe and Africa. His newest book, The First 1,000 Days, was published this month. He's going to be a good one. I've also heard him speak as well. He was on a panel with Ashley recently, and you're going to thoroughly enjoy it. So, until next time, see you then.